Hey, everybody. I'm Carolyn Hadlock, and this is the Eunoia podcast. Eunoia is the Greek word for beautiful thinking, and that's what the show is all about. I interview beautiful thinkers who are creatives, founders, authors, and CEOs, and I try to get inside their heads. I just spoke with Adam Lizagor. He is the founder of Sandwich, but he is known for creating videos for new technology, oftentimes apps. If you aren't familiar with his name or his company, you have certainly seen his videos for the likes of Airbnb, Uber. If it's a new app and it has a good video, he's behind it. So how are you? How's your day going? Or your morning, I guess?
My morning is okay. I did a little Peloton, and I did an 80s ride, and one of the last tracks was Ain't Nobody by Chaka Khan, which is an incredible composition, really. It's an incredible piece of classical pop music, and it just got me in a good place mentally. So I'm ready.
Good. Well, thank you for agreeing to talk to me. I've been a fan of your work, I think actually since you started, because you just celebrated a 10-year, right?
Yeah, just yesterday.
Oh, wow. Happy decade anniversary.
Thank you.
I was interested when I was reading about how you seem to lean into accidents and making mistakes in only the way that you can. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, where did that philosophy come from, and how has it served you?
I don't know. I'm pretty sure I stole it from somewhere, but it's a hodgepodge of different expressions that I've come across over the many years. But it's sort of a known concept culturally in Japan. They call it wabi-sabi, the idea of sort of making something as perfect as you can, and then messing it up a little bit, because in that act of messing it up a little bit is where you introduce chaos in the way that only you can. And it's not that imperfection is intentional in that regard for me, but I think that imperfection as an artifact of just being an individual is, I think, where most interesting work comes from. And so I just the perfect summation of that idea is that you make mistakes the way that only you can, and ultimately that's your voice. You know, your voice is, how to put it, like, I'm no scientist, but your voice, your literal voice, the timbre of your voice is a series of disruptions to the flow of air, which creates sound waves, right? That's true for any musical instrument. So there's all these imperfections at different wavelengths, and that's what we call timbre, and that's what makes the instrument sound the way it does. And no two trumpets sound the same, and no two pianos sound the same, because they have different imperfections. And I think the same is true with creative work as well.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I love the concept of wabi-sabi and, you know, beautiful thinking, which is what this blog is about. Yeah. And beautiful thinkers.
I love that. It's such a good word.
Yeah. What? You like Eunoia?
Oh, I do. Yeah.
Man, I have so many people telling me I should ditch it because it's hard to pronounce. But I think that's the magic of it. That's the allure.
Boo. Hard to pronounce is no good reason to not like a name. There are plenty of people on NPR, you know, like reporters on NPR who would disagree with that model of thinking.
Yeah. Had you heard of that word before?
You know, I have. I don't think that I had retained it in the way that, like, you come across some words like this, like, I don't know, anhedonia, or I forget. There's a word that means seeing patterns where none exists, and I always forget that word, but it comes, directly from a Greek root. And I love those kind of words, you know, the words that are very much just portmanteau of two like core concepts coming together to say something true, but we don't have a common English, word to describe that thing.
I like that. Well, one of the things, and I've leaned into some Japanese culture, because that's the culture that really, especially in the realm of beautiful thinking, I really love how they think about it. But one of the constructs, it's one of the foundational concepts is people either ask if it's, is it good, is it bad, but is it beautiful? And that's really the space that I like to lean into, to kind of pull out of that sort of black and white space and find the subtleties and the nuance in between. It was interesting. I was watching one of your interviews this morning, and you showed the Willy Wonka scene. Do you remember that, when the in the white space?
Oh, sure. Yeah. That was like the first talk I ever gave at UX Week, I think. It was video as user experience.
Yeah, 2011.
Yeah.
But I love that scene as a kid. I loved it. And it's still cool. I mean, even though it's clunky and it's, you know, the production values have come a million miles, but it's still, I just remember that suspended magic that, you know, I felt. But it also gave me an interesting sort of key into your work, which is, I didn't really process this because a lot of your video seems very simple on the face, but actually is pretty, there's a lot of complicated choices that go into it. I'm just curious, like, how would you describe, if you were just talking to somebody who had never seen one of your videos before, how would you describe what you do?
Sure. Yeah, it's a good question. I think that the simplest answer is trying to convey ideas about the digital world using physical space and the limitations of physical optical tools. I think this just came from early on. I recognized in myself that I would watch TV or commercials or whatever, and I would pick up on patterns. So, like, I'm somebody who practices pattern recognition just because that's the way that my brain works. Because I like to associate things and try to use it to make sense of the world. So as I became more fascinated by the digital world as a kid, I found that as the world of tech was becoming more interesting, I started thinking a lot about how do I represent the digital world using the physical world and the tools and language of the physical world using physical space, just like they did in the Mike TV sequence in Willy Wonka, where they have to represent this idea of vast abstract televisual space, right? Mm-hmm. And back then it was pre-digital, obviously. It was televisual. In the McLuhan days, it was the broadcast airwaves.
Yeah.
That was their internet. So how do they depict that? How do they represent that spatially, most importantly? And they did what The Matrix did, you know, three decades later, which was really cool. It was like, okay, it's white space. It's a white space, which is a familiar concept to designers, and it's just this idea that this space is infinite, and we can fill it with artifacts of our choosing, and we can sort of construct a world. And that's what they did for Mike TV, it was really cool. You know, like, you pick up on that kind of thing as a kid, as an adult, I think probably more often as a kid unconsciously. And I just never wanted to lose that sense, you know, that sense of picking up on little cues, because I think those things have a huge impact on people in undetected ways, in unknown or unvoiced ways. I think that's all the stuff that makes culture worth experiencing, is the accidents, you know?
Yeah. So walk me through a process when you, I know that you are very big on, in your team, you only do things that you believe in because you have to believe in it to actually explain it and be behind it. So that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. But how does it work? Like, how does the creative process work with somebody who hires you?
Yeah, I mean, it's really kind of off the cuff. It's a three-step process. It's like, is this a good thing? Is it good for the world? Is it something that I would want to be associated with it? Number two is it good intrinsically? Is it high quality as an endeavor or a work? And then probably third and maybe most important is, are we the right people to tell the story? Because there mm-hmm. are some things that are great, good and great, that a lot of different people can tell that story in great ways. And I don't necessarily want to spend our resources telling those stories. But there are the stories that I think that we are really good at telling, because we're able to sort of dig in and get to the meat of what makes the value and sort of synthesize that into something that other people can understand. That's what we do. And those are the stories that I want to tell. If it's like, if it's a new thing that the world has never seen, and it seems like people are going to have a difficult time comprehending it, and even the client a lot of times has no idea how to convey that value, even though they know it because they built it and they discovered it.
But they can't articulate it.
Yeah, they can't articulate it. So that's like sort of the heuristic that I like to approach choosing clients with.
And then once they pass those gates, do you then do scripts? I mean, earlier when we started this conversation, you talked about voice, which is definitely something that comes through on your work. But I'm just curious how the creative process works with a client, and how you sort of control's too strong of a word, but how do you keep things in the space that you want to?
Yeah, it's changed a little bit over the years as the clients that we work with are changing, and the marketing language changes a bit. And it used to be when we first started out, maybe the first 5 years or something, because we'd sort of developed all these subgenres of the work that we do, we would, like, let's say a startup would come to us and they would say, okay, here is our thing. We need people to know about it. And then we would say, okay, well, we can do this in like 5 different ways. Which one do you want? How about this one? Does this sound right? And they would say, sure. Okay, cool. Let's try that. And then we would do it. And that was a fun sort of Wild West time to make creative work where it's a little bit less supervised or dictated by your client.
Yeah.
Now we are working with clients a lot more who do have stronger ideas about the approach or the strategy, or maybe they're coming with tons and tons of background on the ways to communicate that they know will be successful or you know, achieve results. I mean, if you were to boil it down and sort of dispose of all of the ad speak and like the marketing jargon and RFPs and all that stuff, it's really like a client comes to us, they say, here is what we are working with. And we say, okay, here is how we model it. I like to use that word model as a verb a lot because it just means, how do I take an idea and form it into a representation of itself in a concise and digestible way? And then how do we make that into a story? You know, how do we take that model and present it to the world?
Mm-hmm. I love that you put your interviews on your site because it's fun to go back in time and see some of these things. But one of the things you talked about was that you were positioned yourself more as an educator than a storyteller. Mm-hmm. Is that how you still think about it?
No, I think I kind of do think about it that way still. I used to find the word story pretty distasteful in our work, in the creative work in general, just because I thought it was overused. And it feels a little bit self-important, and I think a lot of marketers were using it wrong. You know, maybe going back 5, 6, 7 years ago, you would hear it thrown around all the time, and to the point that it became a little bit meaningless. But it took me some maturing, I think, to understand what it actually meant. And I love when that happens, by the way. I love when I give myself the time and space to understand something in a way that I didn't before.
Yeah.
Because I've changed, not because it has changed.
Right.
And now the way I understand story, and I think the way that marketers have been using it, is that it's taking a message and modeling it in a chronologically ordered, you know, path so that other people can appreciate the message the way that it was intended to be appreciated. It's, you know, a story to me is like making a message in time the way that a building is making a message in space. I think there's a lot of parallel between storytelling and architecture.
Yeah, interesting. to me, when clients talk about storytelling, it kind of means they just want to talk about the products and features. Yeah. Or the features and benefits of their product, which is really fascinating when it comes to you, because that's actually what you do, but in a very compelling and interesting way.
Yeah, you do it in a way that, you know, I always say presenting the ideas, the right ideas in the right order so that people can understand them. It's just, mm-hmm. It's always a journey. It's always an arc from going, it's an arc that takes you from a place of not knowing about something to knowing about it and understanding it. And that arc from not knowing to knowing, that's the story. If you want to call that story, then that's story. It also is the same model when you're being taught something, you know, by a teacher, by an educator, by, you know, somebody who knows the thing, an expert, a parent. They're taking you from a place of not knowing to a place of understanding. And I guess mm-hmm. that can be considered story as well.
Yeah. How did you feel about the specialization, because you're branching out, but initially that, you know, oh, he's the guy that you go to when you have an app and you're a startup to mm-hmm. do the video. Was that something you embraced, or was that something that you didn't like, or how did you feel about that?
100% embraced it. I love it.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it's a wonderful space to be in. I think it's a wonderful thing to be able to claim, you know, stake claim to, or even own. Because I don't think that there weren't any other agencies doing that specifically. So to me, I had just accidentally hit on something with a lot of value and opportunity, and why wouldn't I embrace that? And it yeah. and a lot of people, I think maybe some of the subtext or the implication of the question is, did I feel limited by that as a filmmaker? And my answer to that is no, because it's not like I'm a frustrated movie maker. I do that thing that I do, and I like doing it, and there's a need for it, and it has a good amount of value. So I want to continue to do that, and I don't want to try to discover the parts of myself that are untapped as an artist or a filmmaker. I don't necessarily want to do that, or I don't want to struggle with it. I don't want to regret it.
Yeah. So do you think are you using different creative faculties when you're doing something like a Rothy's versus doing something for Square?
In a certain sense, yes. But I think there are some basics that apply to everything. And really, like, a core principle is figure out how something makes you feel as the user, and then try to model that feeling for the audience. And that's going to be the same whether it's a shoe made out of, you know, 3D printed recycled materials, or a thing that you plug into your phone to swipe credit cards. There's a feeling that's intrinsic to both of those products. And my job as, again, you know, a storyteller about those products is to help people understand what is that emotional journey.
Yeah. And to get to that, do you do any upfront research, or is it relying on just your intuition of how things work and how they need to be explained?
Some things require some research, or some things require a lot of the legwork that the marketing departments have done at our clients. Some things there is no research. You know, some things it's really just, it's intuitive. We just released a spot yesterday for a product called Outpay, which is, it's a really interesting story. I mean, just as a business story, but it was a former client of ours that had spent like 4 years working on a product that tied into all points of sale at bars, so that people could basically walk into a bar, open a tab automatically, do all their drinking, leave, you know, walk out of the bar. They've automatically paid and closed their tab, and then they get an Uber ride to their next destination. It was a really interesting model that was all paid for by the alcohol brands. So they spent years working on it and building it and tuning it to perfection. And then the pandemic happened like 2 weeks after they'd launched, and they were like, crap, our entire business goes away in the snap of a finger. And they wallowed a little bit. And then they realized that they'd built in their point of sale solution, they'd built contactless payments and tab opening in a way that would be very, very valuable for restaurants moving forward. So they sort of accidentally crafted this perfect business solution to a problem that every restaurant is going to have now. So there was no prior experience with this. There was no market research for outpay. It was literally just imagine this solution, imagine all the problems that it solves, and help people understand, like, number one, it's scary to go into a restaurant, so you want to feel protected and safe. And then that sort of like futurist high-tech experience of being able to get up and walk out of a restaurant and everything's just happened seamlessly without you having to do anything. Once you model that emotional experience for people, they understand it.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought to think of how you use technology as a way to preserve the human element, not displace it. Tell me why you have a casting director on staff.
Oh, she's my life partner.
Oh, okay.
She's the mother of my children. Okay, so the backstory of me as like a person that appears on camera is that I didn't intend to be on camera. I went to film school at NYU, and then I didn't intend to be on camera for anything. But when a friend of mine and I developed an app, and then we were going to put the app out, and I decided to make a commercial, I did not know anything about working with an actor, even though I'd gone to film school. It's just not familiar or comfortable to me. Mm-hmm. So I decided, okay, instead of working with an actor, I'll just put myself on camera. right? And then I thought it was a one-time deal, but then, you know, Square had me be on camera and Flipboard had me be on camera and, you know, a number of other clients. And then that's how that whole thing started. But along the way, I knew that I couldn't be on camera for everything we did for a client. So I had to sort of figure out what that process was for working with actors. Well, my partner, Roxana, who I've been with for 16 years, she comes from a casting background. And so basically when I was starting up Sandwich, she figured out the pipeline for going out there and finding non-union talent that was very much like diamond in the rough, like mm-hmm. untested. Some of them were like just great finds that had never gone out for an audition before. And we realized that the tremendous value of that as a creative process to go out and find untapped talent, because you're opening up the world of possibilities for people who don't look like, you know, professional actors, who don't resemble what the world is kind of accustomed to seeing on camera.
Yeah, that's that imperfection.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So we sort of just integrated in that into the language of what we do is like finding people that you wouldn't see on camera but are great on camera and look great and sound great and are unique and maybe represent people that aren't, you know, from backgrounds that aren't represented in media so much. And there's like just like a whole level of authenticity, credibility, vulnerability, and amazingness that happens when you avail yourself to that opportunity. So Roxana was very, very integral to figuring out that pipeline in a very, very cool and repeatable way. So we could just go out there. Every job is, you know, the casting process is similar to what it was when we started, which is we go out there sort of open to a certain, you know, specification, and we try to keep an open mind, and we go out and find people that we haven't necessarily worked with before that are
interesting,
you know, and that are new to it. And it's just like a really fun, I mean, it's not fun for me. I hate like audition process. That's casting process is the least comfortable thing for me of the whole process.
I agree.
That answers that question. She's, you know, she's the love of my life, and I like having her on our team.
That's awesome. I want to hear a little bit about your venture fund and how that's working out for you.
You know, I love to participate with the clients that we work with from time to time as an investor. And it's a model that we developed early on. And to this point, I think I have about between 40 and 50 portfolio clients, you know, clients that I've done work for that as part of our compensation package, we sort of we get a little bit of equity instead of some of the cash component. And it's really exciting to participate in that way, because I didn't really know much about the industry, the venture industry. And I didn't know whether everything was going to be a hit, because it felt like it was going to be a hit, or if they were going to be all failures. or somewhere in between.
Yeah. What was your kind of expected ratio of hits versus fails?
My expectation, probably like 1 in 10.
Really?
Would be okay. A hit. Yeah. And that's probably where I'm at. None of them have really borne out in a huge way yet. But I have done this with some significant unicorn clients that I'm pretty excited about. So it's not a model that I'm giving up. It's just something that I'm doing a lot less these days.
Yeah.
You know, people starting a company like mine come to me and they say, how do we work this out? How can you tell us how to do an equity deal? And my advice is, if you're just starting out, don't necessarily stake any hopes and dreams on that. It's mostly not going to work out. It's most common that the companies that you're going to be working with are not slam dunks. So I'd be wary of equity as a way to make money, because mostly you're just going to be paying out of your own pocket.
Yeah. So then what's the intangible benefit of equity if it's not financial?
Well, if you're in a comfortable place cash flow wise, and you can forego a little bit of that revenue to put a little skin in the game, and you know, sometimes it's interesting. But if you really enjoy that, if you really enjoy taking that risk, then go for it. But I don't enjoy taking that risk, honestly. I don't gamble. I don't really play the stocks. I'm a little bit more conservative financially. So I've taken the opportunity when it's been offered to me, and I've been lucky enough that opportunity has been offered to me by some really significant companies. But it's not a way to build a business, for sure.
And I would think it would give you more trust too. You know, having, like you said, that skin in the game, it might give you a little bit more of a lever with the client.
Yeah, and I mean, they sometimes they do see it as that extra, credibility. Or if the client sees that you're willing to take them on as an investment, then they believe the things that you say. It's not about just earning a buck. It's about really needing things to go well. In the ad world, you are seeing some agencies that are doing more towards building businesses as a model. You know, they're not just doing client work for hire. They're actually trying to build businesses themselves using their own resources and assets. I think that's kind of interesting.
So I know you did an article, or you contributed to an article, which I thought was very cool, about where we are today with coronavirus and needing to work remotely. Mm-hmm. If you had to give three pieces of advice to somebody to kind of up their remote working game with video conferencing, what would those be?
Doing creative work, like making creative stuff remotely, or just working together as a team?
Collaborating, yeah.
Collaborating. Oh, gosh. Well, I'm not going to say that I know that we're doing it right. So the things that are important to me, like I'm a nerd, like I'm a gear nerd, which has been reinvigorated by this whole the pandemic situation. So I realized that I like that idea of paying attention to the fidelity of my setup, my presentations. A little bit more obsessively, I would say. So like, you know, just paying a little bit more attention to your light, to your sound situation, most importantly, to your, you know, to what the camera is. Like, don't just use what falls off the truck as the way that you interact with your coworkers and your team and your clients, because you're not necessarily putting your best foot forward. So, you know, get a mic that's a little bit closer to your mouth. There's a really cool app. There are a couple of them, but my current favorite is called Camo. And it's a way to use your iPhone as your webcam. And, you know, I don't know how many people are aware just how terrible the camera on your MacBook or your iMac really is. It is an absolute garbage piece of hardware for a thing that's attached to a $2,000 or $3,000 machine.
Yeah.
And I think if Apple had known this was coming, they probably would have invested a few cents more into that piece of hardware. But something that you can do about it is you can either attach a separate camera, like a dedicated camera. I attach a separate, you know, like nicer camera and use that as my webcam. But the easiest solution is you get a little mount for your iPhone and you plug it in to, you know, USB into your computer. And then this software, Camo, lets you select that as your video source. And you're going to look so much better. It's crisper. And I don't know, just let people see you and let people hear you. And the quality of that experience with higher fidelity makes it feel like you're more present with each other. Because that's the thing that's lacking. That's the thing that I see lacking in my 7-year-old son's, you know, online school Zoom classes is that sense of presence. And, you know, on a high level, we were talking about technology, the purpose of technology before, is that technology is there to enable truer human capabilities. And some of that is interacting with each other. Like a large part of that is interacting with each other. So we shouldn't let technology get in the way of that. We should let technology enhance that so that we do feel like we're present with each other. And I would say for a creative team especially, that presence with each other is very, very important.
Okay, I'm going to ask you one more question and then I will let you go. How would you define beautiful thinking?
I would bring it all back to patterns. And associations. And I think that we are, to a large degree, not entirely, but we are to a large degree, a collection of our past and our experiences and our memories. You know, we are sort of like we're the representatives to the outside world of our own memory palace. And so I think that because we have this capacity, our brains have the capacity to store our memories and our experiences. And because we have the capacity to associate those memories and experiences with each other, to me, my favorite thing to do is make those associations. How does this thing I just experienced remind me of something that I experienced in the past? And then what can I do with that information? What can I make with that pattern? Can I make something new? Can I make something beautiful? To me, that is probably my favorite form of beautiful thinking.
Well, Adam, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to chat with you, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Carolyn. This has been fun. I appreciate the conversation.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as we did. And I hope you took something from it. Something that'll help you with your next meeting, next pitch, your next big project. But above all, I hope it inspires you to think strange, different, new, and beautiful thoughts. For more from this interview and other chats with beautiful thinkers, visit carolynhadlock.com to subscribe on Medium and follow at UNOIA Quarterly on Instagram. That's EUNOIA Quarterly.